The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Midpoint Library System, Clark County Public Library, and the Dayton Metro Library.
Good morning. You are listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. I'm Vic McCunis. We have the Book Nook coming up for you this morning. Today, my guest will be Julius Bailey. His new book is Racial Realities and Post-Racial Dreams, The Age of Obama and Beyond. As we wind down the final year of President Obama's final term and prepare for a new presidency, we're looking back at the Obama years. Julius Bailey takes a close look, and he'll be in Xenia later today. Find out more by listening to the Book Nook, coming up following NPR News. Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Julius Bailey. He joins us in studio, and he has just published a book called Racial Realities and Post-Racial Dreams, The Age of Obama and Beyond. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Vic, and thank you for having me.
And as we prepare to say goodbye to President Barack Obama, they're calling him a lame duck. We're winding down this last term. They're saying that he can't name the new Supreme Court justice because he's a lame duck, but he's still very much our president. And as we prepare for his departure from office, your book is very timely. Why did you decide to write this?
Well, I think there's probably three main reasons. One had to do with this sort of feeling I had about Obama, this love that I had for what he represents in history, but also a misgiving in terms of not only how I felt, you know, he was treated as president or issues of legislative obstructionism, but also there's some policy issues that I had certain problems with. And so as I thought about ending up this particular period of his administration, I thought about what will history say about him, right? And I do recognize that part of the Republican attack of Obama has basically been to make sure history don't say too much about him, right? To almost erase the way, the impact legislatively anyway, that Obama would have. And so I wanted to see how that plays out on paper. But then as a professor, I wanted to kind of talk about how Obama got here. So that chapter two that you're referencing, that chapter two talks about how Obama got here. What were the ongoing sort of undergirding pattern of racism, of sort of anti-personhood, if you will? Easily the question of he's not even American, that kind of question that come up, and how that kept going on from even before he became president to even now that he goes out. So, I mean, that's the historian of me wanted to kind of speak that language. The romanticist in me, if you will, wanted to have a conversation with America, wanted to engage myself in what it is like to love something so much, but yet not feel the reciprocation of that love. And so this novel, this book is not a novel, but it's novel-like in a sense that I'm telling a sort of a story of what oftentimes feels like unrequited love. Like I'm trying so hard in a democratic spirit to push the best out of this love that I have, named America. But yet America consistently and pretty much true to form shows itself not to love oftentimes people like me in the same way. And I think thirdly, just literally had to do with my body. It literally, as you can see, your eyes aren't tricking me. I'm a big dude, you know. And I thought about what is it like to be big, black, in America, up against the current climate of, you know, black bodies being attacked both inside black communities as well as outside black communities, the groundswell of anti-black violence, the audibilized and very visualized murders or killings of black people on behalf of the nation state and state-sanctioned violence. And two particular cases jumped out at me, Vic, that made me begin the writing. And one was obviously one that we know in John Crawford here in our region, here in Ohio, and thought about what is it like to literally mind your business and doing whatever you're doing, talking to a friend, and life is happening around you, and people are perceiving who you are without you even paying attention to what they're saying, and then to have your life snuffed out in less than 2 seconds. And then Eric Garner, and I talk about that in the book, Eric Garner becomes the impetus, the literal day one of writing, where I'm watching on television, as with America, this 6'3", 300-something-pound man being killed by Danilo Panatello, Officer Panatello. And I'm watching, what is it like to be big, to be black, to be somewhat antagonistic or at least questioning what it's, you know, sort of this idea of freedom, and which we know is what happened in Eric Garner's case, but yet to have your life snuffed out. So I think those are the three prongs, you know, the idea of what it's like to be human in America. What is it like to love something or love America so much and not feel that love back, which everybody can understand that love story. So that's the, you know, groundswell. And then thirdly, about looking at the history, looking at understanding what Obama represents in this era. What were these 7.5 years like that we can speak of in this project?
Julius Bailey joins us. Julius is a professor at Wittenberg in Springfield. His new book is Racial Realities and Post-Racial Dreams, The Age of Obama and Beyond. When President Obama was elected, a lot of people said, okay, it's time to move beyond race. Mm. Didn't happen, did it?
I don't think so, Vic. I think that, you know, we certainly have to applaud the way in which Obama does create a sort of emotional high, right? I mean, from the day that he was elected to the day of inauguration, you know, how you might remember the scores of people, both visual and in their own particular rooms and closets, who cried viscerally because they understood what America has been. And they see the potential of America. And so I think you're right. I think that there's a sense to which that the hurt becomes almost Chekhovian, right? There's this sense of, as Anton Chekhov talks about, this sense of there is a deep-seated compassion and there's a deep-seated love of something. There's this idea that I can gain access to it, but yet there's structures and systems around me that doesn't allow itself to fulfill. And I think that that's what America is. I think America sees itself a little bit better than it is. I think America looks at Obama and looks at Holder and looks at Loretta Lynch and looks at all the people who Obama has put within his cabinet and look at the ways in which the nation, look at Michelle and the kids and what this means to the history of America visually. As one of my students say, I think the lights came on and some of the racist roaches started running around. And now we began to sort of see more of almost what it looks like in the night, what it may have looked like in the 50s and the 60s. What is it like to not to have a voice, to have a voice to hate and to hurt and to harm? And then I think I don't blame Obama for that, but I certainly realize that this Obama administration has just turned the lights on a racist America and a classist America that literally renders the poor and renders black people particularly, but not exclusively, invisible.
And then there's the brutal reality of actually being the president of this country. And no matter what was said in the speeches during the campaigns by any of the candidates, but particularly by the winning candidate, President Obama, the promises that are made in campaigns and the aspirations and hopes that we mm-hmm. might have to be fulfilled. He's been very much a war president, yeah. even after winning the Nobel Peace Prize to start off his presidency. Some of us have been very disappointed by some of the things that have happened.
I mean, Vic, when I tell you that I agree with you wholeheartedly, I think that, you know, we have to, I mean, I was one of the people who, you know, when he received that Nobel Prize was just kind of dumbfounded, right? I mean, not only because, the brother ain't done nothing yet, right? But that's one issue. But two is just realizing that, you know, the awesome history of individuals who have held that prize, right? And what not only they represented, but what they have done. Right. So there is a sense of actuality, not just potentiality. Right. And so when he received that prize in 08, I was like, whoa, 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 let's back up. But then, like you said, he talked about withdrawing troops. He talked about getting rid of Guantanamo. He talked about ensuring that America becomes less dependent on other countries become less dependent on us. And we look at home. First, and it had that language, but you're right. He hit the ground running. He added troops and he began to become the droning president and killing folks across the world. And Guantanamo still ain't closed. And we still have deaths in Afghanistan. And yes, he was responsible for the killing of Osama bin Laden but that's just one aspect of that particular reality. And so I think that we have to look at our nation and say, well, you know, Obama, you know, and you know, our brown brothers and sisters would say, you know, he's the deporter in chief. You know, he's deported more people than any of these former presidents in the past five or six generations. And so, you know, so you start questioning, you know, is there something particular about his early steps that would cause him to resist race, right? Mm. Maybe I don't want to be seen. And he says, I'm not a black president. This isn't a black America, white America. These are the United States of America. So then he became, as Cornel West called him, almost a puppet of imperialism. Mm-hmm. And so that, as a progressive, Vic, we know we have to challenge those type of moves. I mean, everything from bailing out the banks, say, well, for American economy, that becomes important. I can't necessarily deny that, but the reality is no question that they performed not just immoral acts, but illegal acts, and nobody went to jail for them. Mm. So, I mean, what do we say about that? When he begins his first cabinet, his financial cabinet with Geithner, and I mean, these are folk who were a part of an imperialist system that created the very problem that we had. And he began to bring those individuals into his cabinet when he first started, I guess to, you know, create an olive branch across the aisle. I don't know what that was, but the reality is he recapitulated and almost doubled down on what George Bush represented on his way out.
Well, as they used to say in my old hometown, if you lie down with dogs, you're going to wake up with fleas. My guest is Julius Bailey. The book is Racial Realities and Post-Racial Dreams, The Age of Obama and Beyond. He joins us in studio today, and you can meet him. He will be in Xenia this afternoon for an event at Blue Jacket Books, 30 South Detroit Street in Xenia, 2 o'clock until 4 o'clock this afternoon. He'll be speaking, and Dr. Kevin Magruder, who has been on this program, a professor at Antioch College, will be the moderator of this event this afternoon at 2 o'clock at Blue Jacket Books. He'll be signing copies of his new book, and the Book Nook will continue right after this. You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'm absolutely thrilled to have Julius Bailey in studio to have a conversation today about his new book, Racial Realities and Post-Racial Dreams, The Age of Obama and Beyond. Julius will have an event this afternoon at Blue Jacket Books in Xenia at 2 o'clock. You can meet him and hear him talk about the book, and Kevin Magruder will be moderating the discussion today at 2 o'clock. That's at 30 South Detroit Street in Xenia. Julius, you call yourself a Christian existentialist. What is that?
Wow. I don't think we have enough time, Vic, for that one. But I'll try to give the quick Cliff Notes version, right? I think what it means, Vic, is that I represent a tradition that sees individual responsibility at the forefront of our morality. I think that I don't look to necessarily ascribe to any type of biblical principle, any type of Quranic principle, any type of Buddhist principle. I'm not looking for, you know, that to define what it means to be good in America or to be happy in America. I look at myself and say, you know, what is it about my relationship with others? What is it about who I am as an individual that then defines my ability to relate to others? And so I reject dogma, but I do appreciate culture, right? So I go to church, right? I love church. But I love church probably different than a lot of people do. I love it culturally. I love the get-together. I love the familial aspect of it. I love the conversation. I love the instruction. But I take a step back and I raise questions of whether or not the instruction is actually or more sort of a symbolically divine, right? I think as an existentialist who is also Christian, I am locked into this sort of resistance and fight against oppression. I think I look at the way in which I look at Jesus as a sort of as a radical figure. I look at Jesus as a disruptor of the comfortable, right? As well as the comforter of the disturbed, right? I look at him in both those sort of prisms. I look at myself in that same vein, right? But I see myself in the existentialist tradition. I see myself almost like Sisyphus, right? Always pushing up a proverbial rock, up a proverbial hill. This particular book, this sort of adherence to a democratic spirit that somehow I can envision an America that lives up to its ideal is a Sisyphean quest. Mm. Right. Mm-hmm. And the rock is going to continually come down and we're going to continue to have conversations like this and how to push America forward, how to deal with issues of race, class and homophobia and xenophobia and all these type of things, which I address in this book. But at the same time, I realize that I cannot count on and or rely upon systems or structures to make those changes. In a democracy, it is an individual action and individuals. Common individuals, like individuals, engaged in progressive activity that pushes it to the fore. I believe in pain and suffering. I think that there are more sad days than good days in life. I think as an existentialist, I realize that who I am is constantly in development and not necessarily ordained before me, right? I believe that our existence precedes our essence and not our essence that precedes our existence, right? So we're constantly and contextually recreating oneself within the world as we, you know, sort of involve ourselves among others. That's a small aspect, but I hold on to Jesus, Vic, only because I realize that the amount of anger, the amount of suffering, the amount of pain in the world, if I didn't have an anchor to hold on to, if I didn't keep the cross on my ring right here, that I might sort of relegate into a sort of a hateful spirit. And I think what Jesus does for me more, even more than a salvation for the Christians, even more than the stories of the Bible, I think what Jesus represents for me more is hope, is understanding that even a wretch like myself, even a blind individual like myself, even a tormented soul has potential. And I think in the same way that I look at America, even its blindnesses, even its tormented selves, even its cancerous spirit sometime has the ability with our understanding of a God that's bigger than us to lead all of us in the demos into an elevated self.
Julius, you're from Chicago, which is the city that we associate with President Obama. And in your book, Racial Realities and Post-Racial Dreams, The Age of Obama and Beyond, you remind us of when President Obama was just a candidate Obama, Senator Obama, running for office for the first time as president. And he was attacked for his attendance at a particular church in Chicago mm-hmm. and his association with a particular minister. And the right-wing media really went after him and just excoriated him for his association with this minister. He then proceeded to distance himself from this minister. You took a couple quotes from the minister in your book, and I read them, and I thought, you know, this guy is right on. Obviously, you picked some particular quotes, but I agreed with them.
Well, I think, you know, I am biased in there, Vic, so I got to be careful here, right? So those in your listening audience should know that I literally grew up, you know, six blocks away from Trinity United Church of Christ. My fifth grade year through my eighth grade year of grammar school was literally across the street from Trinity. I know one of Reverend Wright's daughters very well. I was actually married at Trinity. And so there is a connection I have with Trinity. So I must be honest with that.
And you and Obama were married in the same church.
And it's at the same church, right? And so I think, does that mean I'm about to become president, right? But no. But I think what Jeremiah Wright has always represented, and what he represents even now as the ex-pastor of the church, is someone who sees the Bible and sees black people specifically as an Afrocentric medium. That is to say, if we're going to celebrate or even emulate a God, we need to understand, we need to be able to construct that God as a spirit to be connected with us as a people. And we have to somehow, you know, reteach, if you will, what it means to be Christian in America under oppressive and racist analysis. And so Jeremiah Wright comes from that sort of black radical tradition, or what they call the sort of a liberation theology, right, that has a lot of its roots in South America, but certainly through the theological father James Cone and his work. And so Obama, as the tenants of his church, as Jeremiah Wright says, as a tenants of his church that I knew from being a kid when I would just visit, he says, we at Trinity is unapologetically black and unashamedly Christian. And so at no point does he teach, so he has consistently taught that type of religious understanding amongst his people. And so, but yes, Vic, in a country that is afraid of what the Greeks would call parhesia, that sort of frank and honest speech, in a country that vilifies all those who upset sensibilities, even liberal sensibilities, that sort of hard left, pro-black, Afrocentric, some might even call anti-white language unnerves people. And so I know Jeremiah Wright to love everybody. I know United Methodist people, the Church of Christ people coming and laying on his feet and talking to him and being preached at and prayed for. I know that growing up around him, being there even at the time that Obama was there. But when a person wants to speak frankly to America in the way in which even this book tries to do, and when you do that behind the pulpit, and then you understand the history of separate spaces, black-white church relationship on Sundays, that kind of stuff. You put all that in the mix and you say, what was going on there? Nothing that wasn't going on with the AME church or when it was founded, right? A sort of an understanding of what it means to be black and Christian at the same time, to look at an America through the prism of black bodies and black society and black history and black understanding. And I think that's what he represented in the Obama. And Obama honestly said, look, I learned a lot from him. But then he had to separate himself when he became this particular entity because of the weight of race just kind of came upon him.
Did Reverend Wright actually perform your wedding ceremony?
Actually, that day he didn't.
Okay.
So checking. Michael Flager,
who wrote the introduction,
okay, who many in the audience might, you know, have seen a lot on CNN and conversations, he actually performed the ceremony as a Catholic priest in this particular church, along with Reverend Reggie Williams and Wanda, Reverend Wanda. I had about four ministers in front of us. But Jeremiah Wright's, his family was there because they appreciate the work that I did. So he wasn't there, but the church was, everybody was there. It was a full, it was a wonderful moment. But Vic, Obama, though, is interesting, right? Because one thing that I think about is that, you know, not only did he sort of cowtail to that pressure against Wright, but he also, if you remember, had to denounce Farrakhan, you know, through a Clinton, Hillary Clinton,
mm-hmm.
right? And then I think about Wright, I think about Farrakhan again. I'm not a Muslim brother, but I know Farrakhan's work. I know Farrakhan's work in the community. I know his love for his people. And to hear Obama deny both those individuals who on the south side of Chicago, it is unheard of to think that they don't love black people. And they don't do the best they can do to support black business, black organizations, black education, you know, black morality. Mm-hmm. And to hear him deny them was might have been a precursor for some of us to wonder, what is his administration going to be like when it comes to brothers and sisters in the hood?
Mm-hmm. Julius Bailey joins us. His book is Racial Realities and Post-Racial Dreams, The Age of Obama and Beyond. A number of years ago, when we were still doing this program on the station, and I also did a music show, I had an opportunity to interview Cornel West because he had just contributed to a hip-hop album. And at the time, I thought I was going to get an interview. I was going through the record company, and he became ill, and we didn't do the interview. I understand that he's been a mentor of yours, and I also understand that you're somewhat of an authority on hip-hop. Tell us about all this.
Well, again, these are long stories, but so I met Cornel West first as a as student body president at Howard University, and our students wanted College of Arts and Sciences wanted Cornel West to speak. This was 1992, and so this was the first time he'd ever spoke on campus, and I brought him there. Him and his son Cliff came, and we just hit it off. Quick, fast, in a hurry, he did his homework about me with our chairperson and with the dean and, you know, what is this Bailey guy like intellectually? I was on my way to Princeton to work with him in 94, and that's when he left Princeton to go to Harvard. And so he gave me a call. I remember I was on my way to Princeton to go to school that fall. I was nervous, but I was excited. He called me one April, said, "Oh, brother, we got a problem," you know. And so he said, "I'm headed to Harvard." And I'm like, "What am I going to do? I don't have." And so, but anyway, long story, I ended up going to Harvard. I ended up being a part of African American Studies there. And so I served two wonderful years as his teaching fellow. The first year, and then as his head teaching fellow the second year, I was privileged to be able to work under him and listening on him and write under him. He had left Harvard, then I ended up going to University of Illinois to get my PhD, and he retained the position of sort of head of my dissertation. He was at my wedding. He was at every important aspect of my life at my dissertation hearing. He was, and so to me, he's like a dad, right? So when I think about this book, right, so the hip hop piece, right, as a student at Harvard, I was Cornell's office was right across the hall from a graduate fellow at the time named Tricia Rose. And Tricia Rose now is the head of African American Studies at Brown, but then had just written her dissertation and then her book called Black Noise. And this is 1996-97. And Tricia and I were talking, and I was interested in hip hop. But again, like you said, I'm from Chicago, so I really wasn't inculcated by it at the time. But then we had another young student named John Caramonica. And John now writes for Spin, Billboard, everywhere. You see his name everywhere over music stuff. John was a student at Harvard. And John really wanted to have a hip hop class. And we had no one at Harvard ever thought about a hip hop class. And so John and myself and Tricia sat down over the course of a semester. John's his senior thesis at Harvard was on the creation of a hip hop pedagogy. And it was since then, since taking that seriously in 1997, where I began to think about hip hop as pedagogy. How do we teach this particular culture? And how do I, as a philosopher, get students to understand what I do philosophically through the prism of this music, through this art form, through this way of life? And since 97, I've been, you know, one of the old heads, if you will, on doing this. But then obviously I have the edited volume on Jay-Z, the edited volume on the cultural impact of Kanye West. I have my monograph on philosophy and hip hop, which was at the very beginning of it, says that Cornel West thought I was crazy in 98 when I told him that one day I was going to write the definitive philosophy and hip hop book. And yet here it is. I don't know if it's the definitive, but it certainly came to fruition. And so it was because of people like that in a place like that that allowed me to dare to dream, that allowed me the language and the nuance to understand culture within the context of academia, and then to be able to train my mind and to train my sort of writing to be a better professor among young people who are slowly and now more rapidly inculcated by hip-hop culture.
You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and my guest in studio this morning is Julius Bailey. His new book, Racial Realities and Post-Racial Dreams, The Age of Obama and Beyond. You can meet him this afternoon. He'll be at Blue Jacket Books in Xenia at 2 o'clock, 30 South Detroit Street, doing a book signing. There'll be a discussion. Julius is a professor at Wittenberg University, and he'll be joined by Professor Kevin Magruder from Antioch College, who will be the moderator this afternoon. And you can come out and meet him and hear about this book and get him to sign your book if you're interested in that. That's all this afternoon at 2 o'clock at Blue Jacket Books in Xenia. The Book Nook continues right after this. This is the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. We record the Book Nook here at WYSO every week. Two programs, one coming your way at 7 o'clock on Saturday morning, the other Sunday mornings at 10:30. My guest on the program today is Julius Bailey. He will be at Blue Jacket Books this afternoon in Xenia, 30 South Detroit Street at 2 o'clock to introduce his book, Racial Realities and Post-Racial Dreams, The Age of Obama and Beyond. As we listen to the rhetoric in these political campaigns right now, divisive rhetoric, polarizing rhetoric, crazy talk from some of these candidates, the focus is often on the have-nots. We've got the haves, we've got the have-nots. You talk a lot about that in your book, Julius.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think that we have to pay attention to economics in America. I think that as a capitalist democracy, it is incumbent upon us to be very, very careful in terms of how we build not just our wealth. I'm having that conversation, but how we build our character. And again, back to my Christian self, you know, we are who we are because of how we treat the poor, right? And America hasn't done a good job at treating the poor. Now, what it would do is see itself up against, let's say, a third world country and say, well, we're not that, right? But as we know, too much who's given, much is required. And the danger of an America who sees itself as a superpower but doesn't see its responsibility as being inextricably linked to the ways in which poor children are educated, are treated with health infirmaries, are fed, if it's not paying attention to that, if it's not engaged with the ways in which our mothers, how fast do they have to get back into, you know, into the workplace? How much help do they get with, you know, with respects to food and access to a finance, you know, depending on if they're poor? I think I like to say, Vic, and I think I may represent this book, is that we have clearly the haves. And I think that that's when you hear Bernie Sanders, that's what he's talking about, right? He's talking about that 0.1% that controls 90% of American wealth. Right. The way in which the distribution of wealth is that disparate, even worse than it was in 1950, even worse than it was even in the 1930s. And so that conversation becomes important. But then when you think about where we've come from, when you think about in 2008, Obama comes into an America in which we're all at the brink of bankruptcy. Right. But yet you got these golden parachutes of the rich, and you got this, I mean, the very reason we got into the housing bubble is because of people's greed. So I think we have to pay attention, Vic, you know, what do we look to when we look at the middle class, right? Who are we talking about? How is class developed now in this century? How is class and class identities developed? How is poverty understood? What is the relationship between income, wage inequality, and the ability to effectually be a good parent, right? To educate, right? So you see the disparate relationships between education and income. You see health and income. You see the sort of aspirations and income. So I could not get through this project about racial realities and post-racial dreams without having a conversation about the haves and the have-nots. But then, Vic, people like myself, the have-a-littles, right? I mean, what do we do with the have-a-littles, right? And even us who have a little, we have to always ensure that we're putting pressure and critique to bear upon those individuals who have the ability to make legislative and financial changes. Will Bernie Sanders do it? I don't know. Is Hillary Clinton engaged intellectually with that type of conversation? She doesn't seem to have it in her forefront, but we'll see what happens. Clearly, on the right side of the spectrum, it's about the creation of wealth through ensuring that businesses are more and more involved in America. But it's also about anti-unions, right? It's also about ensuring that, no, we can't raise minimum wage because we raise minimum wage. Now we got to make sure, now we're putting more pressures on small businesses, and we can't have uniform health care because uniform health care, especially with the Obama version, then punishes or ensures that the employer has to pay the premiums. And if the employer doesn't pay the premium, it gets affected. And so you have an ideological problem. Meanwhile, while they're arguing ideologically, poor folk ain't making it. Mm-hmm. States are really looking at the federal government. Alabama and Kentucky, I mean, we can list them all. Alabama, Kentucky, North Carolina, I thank God not Ohio, but who are saying, we don't want none of that Obama money. We don't want none of that Obamacare. We don't want none of that money that then would go into our states that allow us to help the poor. We don't want to do that. So then now, what are you saying to the poor in Mississippi? Or what are you saying to the poor in Kentucky, to Alabama? What are you saying to them? You're saying that I hate Obama enough that I won't even engage in ways in which I can give you more money on your food stamp card. Or I can ensure that you have a health care plan within the state that I get access to this. So I'm willing to almost tear down our budgets just to make sure that I don't align myself with Obama. So this conversation, you know, is not a new conversation, Vic. We know that. But it is one in which, you know, people like Michael Moore, for instance, loves to talk about, right, because of the way in which big banks and big business adversely affects. And then obviously, as we talk about in Chapter 3 in the book, the way in which the haves control politics. And so when you're talking about somebody like me who's trying to, you know, sort of impassion the demos, then you're saying, but wait a minute, you know, Professor Bailey, how can the people who vote become empowered if it's true that big banks and PACs and all the people have access to the legislators and not me?
Well, unfortunately, Julius, there's enough hypocrisy on both sides, or on all sides of many of these issues, to go around. I have a lot of friends that I've known since grade school. We're still friends, regardless of where we might have ended up in life. Some of them have done very well. Some of them have become much more conservative as they've gotten older. I can remember when President Obama was running for reelection that a lot of them were griping and blaming him for the high gas prices and saying it was all his fault. And I haven't heard a single one of them say, you know, gas prices are pretty good right now. Thank you, President Obama. I haven't heard a single one mention it. It's kind of forgotten. And there's hypocrisy on the left. There's hypocrisy on the right. And it's in the middle for those of us that are still straddling the middle. There's plenty of it. Sure. What do you think of this current presidential campaign? I'd like to hear your take on it.
Ooh, Vic. Well, I was one of those misguided individuals who a month ago became a Republican turncoat, right? I hated the idea of Trump so much that I went to Huber Heights and I pulled a Republican ballot and voted for Kasich just to make sure that Trump didn't win. But then in the meantime, we realized that Bernie lost all that thing, and Trump still, you know, was able to get. Now, he didn't win, but I felt empowered. But then I realized, what have I just done, right? And it was funny because, Vic, as I, you know, as the lady asked me, do you want a Republican or a Democratic ballot, I had to whisper. I said, can you give me a Republican ballot? You know, I wasn't want nobody to hear me say it. I was like, oh, my. But, you know, I thought it was funny back in the summer. I have colleagues on my floor at Wittenberg, one Professor Tom Taylor in history, who I love like an uncle, who we would talk about in the summer and early fall as fun. It's an exciting time to engage in politics. But then by October and November, it stopped getting fun. And I became a little bit like, is this Trump guy looking pretty serious? And then I became like, wait a minute, now I'm at the point where I'm nervous, right? I'm nervous for America, both on both sides, but certainly when it comes to a Republican side. So I think, Vic, that as we enter into this conversation, we have to be very careful with the language of America. I mean, Cruz, he doesn't have the sort of the outspoken mass of people who are anti-black, anti-brown, anti-gay, right? But yet he still has the policies that feed into that. Right. And so it's interesting when people say, well, Cruz is a better option. Well, we think that he might be a worse option if, you know, in reality for those of us who are on the political left. Right. But then you think of somebody like Kasich, who you just wonder, you know, what is, you know, I mean, he's like, you know, we're not even sure why he's there. Right. But then I look at the way in which women in Ohio feel about Kasich and how he's done, on issues of women. And I think he's lost the game on that. I look at incarceration issues in this state and I'm like, he's lost the game on that. So I'm not satisfied with anybody on the right. But on the left, you know, I don't know, brother. I think that Bernie is exciting. But Bernie, he doesn't seem realistic, you know, but he certainly is exciting. It's certainly to see him fire up. It's certainly to see young people excited for him. But we had that story with Obama, Vic, you know, people excited, people fired up, people with these lofty goals and lofty ideas and a little bit of nothing. Right. And so then we have in Hillary someone who's not making grand promises and yet still get vilified because of her association with her husband, because of her association even as Secretary of State under Obama and the issues in Benghazi, right? And so, I mean, you know, to me it becomes this sort of, you know, antipathy amongst the aisles, while at the same time the American poor, American people of color, those of us who are trying to fight for justice, none of them outside of Rand Paul had talked about issues of mass incarceration. Right. Mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton has now aligned herself with a few of the parents of young black brothers and sisters who were killed. Right. But I look at that as sounding brass and tinkling cymbals. Right. It symbolifies nothing. And so for me, I for the issues of this book, I'm not sure either party gives me what I need in terms of trying to actualize a more perfect union. I think we're going to struggle another 4 years, Vic, no matter how you look at it, with that particular office and what that office represents. My only hope is that we don't lose sight of what America brings us in terms of its aspirational self, the beauty that America is because of its interracial and sort of cosmopolitan self. Then I think if we listen to the right and we start hating others and isolating people in our particular experiment called democracy, I think we're all going to lose, Vic.
Well, it will be very dispiriting to have another generation vote for none of the above. Mm. My guest is Julius Bailey. His book is Racial Realities and Post-Racial Dreams, The Age of Obama and Beyond. We're witnessing this Supreme Court-sanctioned obscene deluge of money, billions and billions of dollars poured into the electoral process. Mm. And for what? It's chaos. It's absolute chaos. What do you think is going to happen in Cleveland when they have the Republican convention? Do you think it's going to be a brokered convention?
I certainly do. And I certainly think, and I don't know if I'm doing this out of desire or doing it out of rationality, but I do think that Trump is going to be on the outside looking in. I think that it is pretty clear that the quote unquote establishment has no interest in being represented by Trump. I think not just because of him. I think because his policies, his effective, I mean, his effectual a demeanor affects down ballot. Right. And mm-hmm. so and the Republicans aren't necessarily concerned about who's in the White House. We see that with this administration. Right. The Republicans are concerned. Can I keep the House? Can I keep the Senate? And Trump is so divisive that I do believe they're going to do whatever can ease him out. What does Cruz represent? Well, as we know, you know, folk in the House and especially the Senate almost hate the brother. Right. But he is at least as conservative as you can make him. And then he would then have a good counter position to the left and then will allow the down ballot senators and representatives a platform to run on that is consistent with a Republican brand. And so I think what's going to happen is going to be made for TV movies. I think that, you know, I don't think it's in my lifetime. I've never seen it, but I don't want to be there, Vic. I'm telling you that now. I don't want this big black body to be in that space, but I sure enough want to be watching as I see people argue and fight, as I'm sure they're going to be name calling, as I'm sure, but somehow someone is going to rise out of the ashes of this particular inferno in August. And I just don't think it's going to be Donald J. Trump.
And I keep thinking back to the election of 1964. I know you're a student of history, and some of us recall that the Republicans nominated Barry Goldwater, who went down in flames and was sort of like a Ted Cruz candidate. And then we had Lyndon Baines Johnson, who was a pretty amazing, complicated guy. He knew how Congress worked. He won big in 1964. He went on to sign the Voting Rights Act. And I'm guessing that LBJ is probably turning over in his grave right now see what's going on with that.
No question. I think even Reagan is. I think they're both looking at this like, what is this, right? But certainly, I mean, LBJ, clearly, I mean, we know his benefits, especially when it comes to the Voting Rights Act, right, and his relationship with the civil rights. We know the kind of contention that A. Philip Randolph, as well as Martin King, had with LBJ. But certainly they were able to keep pressure upon the brother so that certain, you know, right, good legislation can be passed on behalf of civil rights. But, you know, this conversation on the right now there is no political pressure that these brothers are going to fall whim to that's going to really give a dag on about folk of color in this America. I think at best we might be able to convince someone like a Kasich, if whatever he gets through, to sort of not be as xenophobic as Cruz and as Trump is, and not to say unilaterally, not just we're going to build walls, but we're going to keep Muslims out and that type of language. I think that's kind of beyond the language of Kasich, but I still think, you know, the danger of what they look for. And also, I mean, what is on the other side of that? The world is watching us, right? Mm. So as the world watches us, it's concerned about what is the spirit of America? And so we're concerned about ISIS as the big threat, which I personally don't think is as big to people of color as it is to the nation as it appears to be. But I do think that the more we hate and the more we engage in anti-Muslim activity, I don't think it helps the process of trying to not only, you know, gain allies to stave off that radical jihad activity, but is also going to hurt us when in terms of people who look at America as an aspirational country.
And if you read this new book by Julius Bailey, Racial Realities and Post-Racial Dreams, The Age of Obama and Beyond, you can see he takes a look at the great state of Alabama and how the voting is being suppressed in Alabama. And you can continue this discussion this afternoon. You can meet Julius. He will be at Blue Jacket Books this afternoon in Xenia, 30 South Detroit Street, at 2 o'clock until 4 o'clock. And he'll be talking about the book. This discussion will be moderated by Kevin Magruder, professor of history here at Antioch College. Julius is a professor at Wittenberg in Springfield. And, of course, the event is free. That's this afternoon, 2 o'clock. At Blue Jacket Books. You can meet Julius and check out his new book, Racial Realities and Post-Racial Dreams, The Age of Obama and Beyond. And it's really been a pleasure having you on the program.
I thank you, Vic, and I thank all of those of you who are listening today. And And just know that, you know, this project, Vic, as you know, is a conversation about how to love this country and how to get do whatever my Democratic self can do to get America to love us back. And that means all of us. That means the haves, the have-nots, the have-a-littles. It means those who are Christian and those who are not Christian. It means those who are part of heterosexual lovers and those who are same-sex loving people. America has to see itself if it wants to be that beacon on the hill that it bragged about in the 80s. It needs to realize that that particular light, that particular responsibility entails ensuring that everyone feels a part of this particular country. And Vic, you know, the Christian in me is what drives every page of that particular book. The hip hop in me is the one that sort of says that we have to do this now, right? But the reality is, I thank you for this opportunity. I thank your listeners. I think in general, I thank, you know, public radio and WYSO for this opportunity for continuing to have conversations with authors and those of us who understand that the written word is one of the ways in which we reach history.
You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO for The Book Nook. I'm Vic McKeonis.